Coming up next in This Week in Computer Hardware, gaming on the MacBook Air, yes! A computer case you can move into, 4K desktop monitors, frame rating, Haswell, Trinity, and Richland, an awesome USB 3.0 hub, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 224, recorded July 11th, 2013. MacBook Air Gaming for the win!
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use coupon code TWITCH. And by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting, pay for what you use, doesn't require contract, and offers unlimited devices on one pooled plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit twitch.ting.com.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch's weekly show that aims to bring you the best and most useful news in computer hardware, tablets, operating systems. Actually, we don't care about software. We're all about hardware here at Twitch. And Mr. Hardware himself joining me after his whirlwind tour of England, but not the continent, Mr. Ryan Shrout. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. I sat down to do the show, and I was like, I don't feel like I've been here for a while, because I was in London 2 weeks ago. And then last week, we didn't have a show because of the holiday. I think I forgot what to do. What do we do here?
We talk about computer hardware. You actually should be talking about the computer case of the century, the computer case that has you so happy you are about to vomit from excitement like a small child full of ice cream, the Corsair Obsidian Series 900D case. Do I exaggerate? Is this more case than we can handle?
I'm going to put that quote on the – I'm going to have them put that on the box or on their website at least. That's good hyperbole at the very least. The case itself is actually really, really cool if you like giant, enormous cases. The 900D can basically fit the Corsair 350D inside of it.
Wow.
Which is, the 350D was kind of like a micro ATX design chassis. This is well beyond EATX. I'm trying to remember what the other form factor is. It's like WEATX or something like that. It's like a server board format that's really huge.
It's funny because if you go like a few pictures down, there's a shot of an ATX motherboard inside this case with the side door off. And keep going. That's almost there. Boom. There it is. Pull back. And it's like probably a quarter of the case. The motherboard is less than a quarter of the freaking case.
I mean, now, look how much space there is above it, right? That's what makes it really different, you know, because of the sides and the below. Most cases, you don't really pay attention. But most of the time, the ATX board at the top is kind of at the end of the top of the case. And that is definitely not the case here with the 900.
No pun intended. So I'm counting. I mean, and it's funny, right? Because I'm somebody who has my sort of gaming / Rip Monster 3000 that has, I think at this point, 7 or 8 5.25-inch optical drives inside of it, would be tiny. It would probably be half the size of this machine. I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 drive bays, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 5.25-inch bays, more frickin' cable panels in the back. If you look like to the right and south, like east and south of the motherboard, this is just set up to have all of the cables.
So it actually supports up to 15 hard drives. It only supports 9 in that photo that you see. It only comes with support for 9, but you can buy extra of those drive cages that each support 3, so you can get a total of 15 hard drives in this thing. Mm-hmm. It supports 2 ATX, full-size ATX power supplies.
Nice.
So you can have redundant power supplies in there.
Are the bottom or the top? The bottom, I would say.
They're at the bottom. Okay. Yeah. And they're not horizontal. They're kind of vertical portrait style, or however you want to call it.
Wow.
And I think there's only 4 5.25-inch bays. At least there's only 4 that actually can hold drives. But then the area above that is actually I don't think I have pictures of it. In the video, you can see some, but I don't know where to scroll through. There's support for 5 radiators in this case. So at the top, you can hold a 480 meter radiator. At the bottom, kind of where if you take out those drive cages, you can hold a 480 and a 240 radiator down there. At the front, you can do another 240, and on the back, you can do a 140. So support for 5 radiators. You can obviously use like the self-contained Corsair coolers, or you can, you know, go with a big fancy custom water loop, which is really what this kind of case is built for, right? And it's built to have tons of space for anything you want to do in terms of mods, lighting, cooling, anything like that. And they have, you know, the same kind of Corsair traits that you're used to seeing, like those cable routing holes, right, that make things look nicer, even if you don't really spend the time on it. Although with a case like this, you probably should. The window on it, on the door, is almost as big as it can possibly be, right? They're not trying to hide anything in here. They assume if you're buying this case, you're buying some killer components to put into it, and you want to show it off, right? So the window is almost the size of the door. It's probably as big as they could make it structurally sound, I guess. And then at the bottom, you know, you can also put up to 15 fans in this as well. And then they've got magnetic air filters for all the intakes. They've done a really good job of kind of, you know, making this all purpose for everything. I mean, I don't want to say it would be stupid, but it is overkill. If you buy this case, put that ATX motherboard in it, put one graphics card in it, like one SSD and one hard drive, you're buying the wrong case. You know, unless you plan on expanding later, you're buying the wrong case because you're paying too much. And it's just, I mean, it's big. Like when I had it sitting on the desk next to me, it kind of blocks out half of the studio lights that we have set up for recording because it's just tall and massive. It's not as expensive as you might think, though. $359 on Newegg, $319. I think I saw it for on Amazon, but now it's back up to $340. So
That's a lot of money for a case. I mean, that's
it is
a lot of money for a case. That's also a lot of case.
yeah. And it was kind of interesting as I was writing up this post and creating this video. The Corsair makes 13 different cases now, not including color variations. And that's a lot of cases for a company that not too many years ago only made system memory. It's kind of impressive to see how they've ranged now from the micro ATX of like the 350D. We have an end that's like the cube shaped Air 540. And then now they go all the way back up to the 900D. So they scale the gamut here in terms of what they offer. And it's pretty impressive that, you know, if you look at the front of it design, it's very kind of modest. Like it's not real flashy. You've kind of got that brushed metal finish, so you either love that or you don't love that. I imagine this hasn't been out that long, but so QuakeCon is the first week of August, and I'll be there for that. It may be too soon to see a whole bunch of these in the case mod competitions, but I would imagine like the next year, this will be a very, very popular case for that because it gives you all kinds of room to do neat things inside.
It's funny that you know, you talk about seeing this at QuakeCon and the mods, because it seems like, you know, gamers and you know, high-end content creators are kind of the last bastion of the desktop. I bring this up because of an article that Jeremy posted on PC Perp actually just a couple hours ago. The continuing decline in desktop sales, quote, for the fifth quarter in a row, traditional desktops and laptops have seen a decline in sales globally. This mostly represents a shift in purchasing habits as opposed to an actual decline in the sales of electronics. You know, desktops, of course, started to decline in sale years ago as laptops became more powerful and more users. Quote, now that tablets and smartphones are capable of providing the same experience to many users as a desktop or notebook, consumers are purchasing these devices, which has led to the perceived drop in sales. And yeah, you know, no matter what the talking heads may claim, the desktop is not dead. No tablet on the planet can play Crysis, nor will it handle SPSS. Check out the comments at Slashdot for more entertaining thoughts on the supposed death of the desktop. But it's funny because you look at like fourth quarter 2009, like 90,651,199 desktops, comma, I wonder who counted that. And the, you know, to the fourth quarter in 2012, actually, it's not that big a decline. It's really funny. Like, you look at this number, this graph looks really horrible. It's like, oh, second quarter 2013, 76 million desktops. But, you know, there's not a lot of reason to upgrade right now. We've had these incredibly powerful, like, you know, you're looking at close to 90 million in sales in the fourth quarter of 2012, which is a dip from 2011. Everybody's waiting for Haswell. Windows 8.0 is not what I would call a giant, hopping, raging, upgrade my system now kind of success. I mean, are you concerned, Ryan? Do you feel that your beloved desktop gaming environment will disappear in the obvious gross decline of PC shipments worldwide?
I mean, it's something we've worried about for a long time, really. And right. I don't think it's something that we can really deny and say that, oh, it's all made up numbers. I think that the traditional DIY is definitely a shrinking market. Let me rephrase that. I do not believe that the DIY is a shrinking market, but I definitely believe that, like, desktop sales as a whole are a shrinking market, right? If you go to a big box store like Best Buy, I bet the number of laptops they sell to desktops has got to be 5 to 1 or something like that, right? It's going to be pretty dramatic. But I feel like if the DIY market is shrinking, the audience that we particularly cater to, it's slower than that. And you still have the people that are dedicated to it, right? Every year, you know, one of the reasons I go to QuakeCon and go to some of these bigger LAN parties is because, you know, you see stories like this and you get depressed and you think, oh, my business is going to be gone in 2 years. I better start studying so I can, you know, be an IT guy and all
that kind of stuff. You got the number of that truck driving school, Maverick? I think I'm going to need it.
And then every year I go to QuakeCon, and every year, like, the number of people that show up at our workshop increases, and the excitement that people have over gaming is not any lessened. What is maybe a little bit lessened is their need to upgrade that hardware, right? So it's called QuakeCon, and Quake is not a game that requires a lot of high-end PC hardware, and Quake Live is definitely not one of those things. So it's interesting to see kind of both sides of that. And that's one of the reasons I like going to QuakeCon. It's kind of like a revitalization for me personally okay, we're on the right track. We're still doing cool things. These companies are still putting in the effort and the work behind it. Seeing those types of numbers and graphs doesn't really worry me personally yet.
Yeah, and it's funny. It is like 11% quarter over quarter, year over year, but it's not dead yet, to borrow a line from some of my favorite comedians. I also want to point out to Web2178 in the chat room, Big Box Store from our friends at Wikipedia. A big box store, also a supercenter, superstore, or megastore, is a physically large retail establishment, usually part of a chain. You know, essentially, it's what 25 years ago, 30 years ago would have been a big ass warehouse is now a typical, you know, Walmart, Best Buy, Costco. You know, I could go on and on and on. But the idea is that it's a physically huge store that sells a lot of stuff. You know, and now the warehouses that serve those physically huge stores are football field size. So just a little bit of history. Not too long ago, back when Leo and I were young, stores were small. 20, 30 feet wide, 40 feet deep was a huge place to buy clothes or food. So, yeah, the basically big-ass stores, which is probably all you may see in what part of the world you're in. On a completely random note. On a less random note, you are getting this in soon. Mm-hmm. Asus PQ321 31.5-inch 4K monitor. So it's a 4K 31.5-inch monitor. This sounds like a desktop monitor to me for a mere, brace yourselves, people, this one's going to hurt, $3,499.99. I was getting really excited about this, and then I saw $3,500.
It's $37.99 when it first launched.
Wow.
Discount.
I paid $5,000 for my truck. I'm not ready to pay $3,500 for a desktop monitor. No matter how badly I want 4K, and I want 4K really badly. Is this going to be do you think 4K is going to show up more on computer desktops than it is in living rooms? I mean, what are you thinking about this so far? You haven't seen it yet. It's not in yet, right?
Right. Well, I think I'll have it tomorrow. You know, I think that the 4K is interesting, right? Because I've already tested a version of 4K with that Seiki 50-inch TV.
Right.
At a single HDMI input. It was 30 hertz limited. This monitor will support 60 hertz.
Ooh.
Which is kind of like, you know, the big deal. But it uses MST, which is multiple stream transport. Mm-hmm. So it's actually sending the monitor two signals. So it's kind of like doing two monitor iFinity or two monitor NVIDIA Surround. And then it then merges into one image that the operating system sees. And that is apparently not actually an official Visa standard even yet. And they sent me some documentation with this that, hey, we realize there's no official Visa standard yet, right, but we have all the components in here necessary for it. When it's officially ratified or whatever it is, we'll implement it through a USB firmware update. And all that means is when you plug in your DisplayPort connection into the monitor, you don't have to do any more kind of fancy configuration on the driver side for the graphics in Windows, whereas currently you will, right? If you plug this in, you'll probably have to go into AMD and do an iFinity configuration, two monitors side by side, and then it shows up and boom, you're ready to go. So there's some limitations in that. You know, this is significantly more expensive than that Seiki TV that we use, but it is a true like LED backlit, the IGZO, the indium gallium zinc oxide panel. You know, a great viewing angles apparently, 350 candelas per meter squared. What's that rating called again?
It's not exactly lumens, but yeah, I mean candles per meter squared.
It's a 10-bit RGB display. Like, this is not a, you know, let's make it the cheapest 4K monitor we can. There, this has been for content creation and that kind of stuff, but it is also, you know, I think the last 4K monitor that we looked at getting in was like a Sharp, and it was $15,000 or $20,000 or something like that. So this is a significant jump down from that.
A tax write-offs if you're a video professional, but yeah. Well, it's I mean, I'm excited to actually hear your reaction to gaming at 4K at 60 hertz, because obviously gaming at 4K at 30 hertz was a frustrating and or painful experience.
It wasn't ideal. I wouldn't say it was bad. It was just because the refresh rate was half. Any of the horizontal tearing you get from having VSync disabled was intensified. But if you had VSync on, you really didn't have that issue. The TV itself had some other problems with sharpness and stuff like that. Apparently some firmware updates have been applied that will improve that. But this, you know, you're looking at a high quality display all the way around, 60 hertz. You don't have to worry about necessarily as much with the VSync enabling and disabling. So we plan on, you know, opening this up tomorrow and running some tests on it and hooking it up to an NVIDIA system, hooking it up to an AMD system, and seeing how easy it is to get up and running, and then what kind of performance characteristics do you have? Because it'll be interesting to see, because it is essentially two displays that Windows is seeing, an iFinity and a Surround configuration, does that affect gaming performance? Is it not as turnkey as it should be? And I think our frame rating methodology will lead into that, give some interesting answers.
Speaking of frame rating, you'd actually just posted an article a few days ago comparing Haswell Trinity and Richland integrated graphics. And it's kind of funny because, you know, so much of frame rating has been looking at using multiple GPUs simultaneously and the issues that creates with certain drivers from certain three-letter video card companies, to be too specific, AMD. This is actually, you know, this is using integrated graphics. Does AMD, who has spent so much time touting the extraordinary power of their onboard graphics with their, you know, their APUs, their integrated graphics on their CPUs, how did they fare in this round of frame rating testing?
So it's kind of interesting because most of the time when you look at just single GPU frame rating, just shows you frame rates. There's nothing really that kind of stands out from it. We were really curious to see what we saw on the integrated graphics side, and I thought it was even more interesting. So this was my first really hands-on time with the HD 5000 graphics, which is the slightly upgraded integrated graphics on Haswell. Mm-hmm. All the desktop parts have the GT2. The HD 5000 is actually a GT3-based implementation. Uh-huh. And then It happened to be through an 11-inch MacBook Air that I got my first hands-on time with this. So
funny.
It's a very low power, like 15-watt TDP machine.
Right.
That's APU, or I'm sorry, that's CPU, GPU, you know, SoC as a whole type of thing. And it actually did very, very well. Kind of, we compared it. It's a dual core. I think like 1.3 gigahertz base clock, so fairly low speed processor. Compared it to a quad core Haswell with the 4600, the HD 4600 graphics. Then we compared it to Trinity and Richland, which was a desktop part. And Trinity was probably most of the testing results. Trinity was a little bit faster, but not very much. And considering that it was comparing it to a 15-watt TDP MacBook Air, it's actually a pretty impressive result for AMD's integrated graphics solutions, actually. The only standout from this that may be indicative of things in the future was that in BioShock Infinite, the Trinity and Richland graphics were definitely faster than the two Intel integrated graphics options. And what makes that maybe more compelling is for long, even though Intel has had competent hardware for a while, they've always kind of get more for their drivers and software. BioShock Infinite is the newest game in the five games that we tested, and it happens to be the game that it showed the worst performance in relative to AMD.
Wow. So, and that's the Haswell. Let me make it abundantly clear in case you cannot read the little tiny graphics and you're not up on PC Pro right now. Those two, the pink line that you can barely see and the green line at the bottom are the HD 4600 and HD 5000 Haswell. The orange line on the top is the 6800K plus HD 8670D, the Richland APU. That's a huge difference. That's a almost, in some cases, 20 frames on average, I think. 20 frames per second on average?
Richland, compare it mostly to Trinity, the black line. The Richland part is kind of in there mostly as a, here's how it's relevant to like a desktop performance, because that's a desktop part.
Okay, my bad.
The Trinity part is the mobility Trinity, though, that's been out for 18 months or something like that. It's been out for a while. And the fact that it still has an edge over Haswell, and it's a fairly significant edge for the most part, right, is interesting, and it does not have that big of an edge over it in Left 4 Dead 2 or Skyrim or Dirt 3 or anything like that. So it kind of leads me to believe that maybe Intel's driver team still needs a little bit of pushing to really stay point.
Was Trinity or Haswell playable? I mean, you know, was the game enjoyable at 35 frames per second?
Trinity, yes.
Okay.
With Haswell, probably not. And if you look at Battlefield 3, I think the frame rates might even be a little bit lower. And that's why I kind of categorized the games into light, medium, and heavy.
Right.
I knew that the heavy games were going to be very tough on these particular integrated solutions. Maybe not be super playable.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not in Battlefield 3. But, you know, you can still get relative performance metrics out of it. You know how they're going to compare each way. And what, you know, we did find was the HD 5000, even though it was coupled with a dual-core Haswell part compared to the HD 4600 with the quad-core Haswell part,
mm-hmm.
the HD 5000 was still able to outperform it many times, if not every time, closely match or outperform. So, you know, the idea of maybe you don't need as much CPU power for gaming is kind of validated again there.
Right.
The only time that became a problem is when you see some wildly variant swinging frame times, and that's when the CPU can't keep up providing data to the GPU. So there's a lot of information in there to look at. But
I mean, something that's also worth pointing out is like, wait a minute. So is it the 40? No. Which GPU is inside the MacBook Air?
The HD 5000.
So basically what we're seeing here is that an 11 hours of battery life, weighs like 2 pounds, fits inside of a sandwich bag, laptop can actually do effective gaming on a relatively brand new title.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I was impressed. Like I you know, the MacBook Air, it's, and this was Ken's, he bought an 11-inch MacBook Air, and I thought this didn't have a chance, but it actually did really well. You know, and it kind of made me go, well, maybe that 13-inch MacBook Air would be an interesting part you know, system for me if I could get Windows battery life up there. And it all this testing really made me want is a damn GT3E with the embedded memory to test. I still haven't been able to get my hands on that. And I really want to compare it in these metrics, right? Let's see how it is in efficiency. Let's see how it is in just raw performance. And I think it's very likely that we would see the GT3E parts outperform Trinity and maybe even Richland mobile parts when we get those in as well. Hopefully in the not too distant future, we'll have our hands on some of that, but there aren't any shipping systems yet. So
all I know is, you know, as somebody who made their MacBook, their white MacBook last like freaking 4.5, almost 5 years, all of a sudden after 2 years, I am desperate to upgrade my MacBook Air to the new Haswell part. It just gets every 2 weeks, something else is like, oh, and I can play video games on it, and it has ponies, and it's going to come with hot sauce. Oh, my goodness. Haswell, you are the bomb. Also the bomb, new sponsor for us this week, ProXPN. It's a global virtual private network. Works with almost any internet connection. Here's the idea. You're in a hotel. You're at a coffee shop. You want to do something. Maybe you want to go for a purchase on Amazon, go to your bank, do some business that you want to keep private. And that's not really something you can do in a public Wi-Fi network, especially not a hotel. Nefarious stuff happens in the networks at hotels. If you have a VPN like ProXPN, you can create a secure connection from where you are to a safe space on the internet that ProXPN provides. They keep everything you do hidden online, or everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguising your physical location, giving you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or where you travel to. I do not like using it. In case you haven't figured it out, I do not like using the Wi-Fi at hotels without having a VPN between me and the rest of the world, or at least me and the world in the hotel. ProXPN can actually create that for you. Complete online privacy with a 512-bit encryption tunnel. Works via OpenVPN or PPTP. You can choose. You can protect yourselves. They want to point this out from the ISP's six strikes rule. Keep your personal internet usage private at work. Bypass internet filtering and blocked websites. You like that idea? I certainly do. Bypass geographical restrictions for internet content and online video with worldwide service in the U.S., U.K., Asia, and more, which means I can watch curling video from Canada without being blocked because I have an American IP address. Or conversely, if somebody overseas wants to watch something in the States they can't get to, they can use something like ProXPN to get to it. Look, it makes your internet connection region free. They have it for Windows and Mac. They give you advanced controls. You get to select the programs and the ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. Works with your iOS device, your Android device. You can use your data plan or public or corporate Wi-Fi. There's an incredible level of control here. This is really, really cool, really, really sophisticated. Steve Gibson gave it a great review on Security Now. They got world-class customer support. And, of course, because we're on the Twit Network, we've got a deal for you. Go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for the entire year. Because you're with us here on Twitch, we got a special offer for you. If you use the code Twitch, you will get 20% off for the lifetime of your account. That's like in perpetuity. As long as you have that account, you're going to get a deal. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. And if you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the code Twitch. You're going to get 20% off for the lifetime of your account, less than $5 a month to keep your data safe and keep your information private from prying eyes, which apparently are all over the internet in the United States now. And we want to thank ProXPN for their support of this week in computer hardware.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
Woo-hoo.
So as a follow-up to the first frame rating story, I did want to I posted a secondary story that looked at a different kind of subset. So the first one was only on integrated graphics, and I kind of separated it out that way. I posted another one a couple of days later that looked at the NVIDIA GeForce GTX 760M. So one of the Haswell Plus 4600 notebook that we used for that review also had a discrete NVIDIA GPU on there, but we had disabled it to do the integrated testing, right? Well, we used the discrete and just wanted to see what performance levels were like, and I was thinking about throwing them in with the results of the integrated, but they were a little bit too high, and we kind of throw off all the graphs and make things look a little bit lopsided. But I did find an interesting result. So the performance of the 70 GTX 760M is way, way higher than any of the systems tested in the integrated article, which, you know, people who think that integrated graphics will take over GPU performance on the notebook, they're obviously not worried about gaming at all. But if we think people are moving from desktop to notebooks and they're going to keep gaming, which I think is pretty obviously going to be what happens, these discrete systems are still going to be very important. So while the first page, the Skyrim results are not very interesting, they look exactly how you would expect them to look. If you look at the second page with BioShock Infinite, our frame rating capability performance analysis stuff threw up some interesting results, right? So if you look at the first two graphs on the BioShock Infinite page, if you look at all the way on the right-hand side, if you look at the blue line that represents the 760M, you'll notice that the FRAPS frame rate and the observed frame rate are different. And that is usually indicative of something like drop frames or runt frames. It's usually indicative of a problem in the rendering pipeline. That's what we see with AMD Crossfire a lot. If you look at the graph below that under frame times, you'll see a lot of these drops to 0 milliseconds, which would indicate a frame that took zero amounts of time to render, which is obviously not very possible, and indicates, again, a problem. And if you go to the last page on Dirt 3 and scroll down past all those results, you'll see a screenshot of what is actually happening. What's happening is something, when a system is using NVIDIA Optimus technology, which is a great technology in many ways, it allows you to switch seamlessly between integrated and discrete graphics on a notebook without having to like change a setting or hit a button on the keyboard or anything like that. But what it means from a technological standpoint is that the display is always connected to the integrated graphics. And when you want to use the discrete graphics actually copies the frame buffer contents from its local memory to system memory to then be output through the display of the Intel graphics onto the display, whether it be your integrated monitor or an external monitor and that kind of stuff. But apparently something is happening in that copy process from the NVIDIA discrete into the integrated graphics where it's getting held up either from an NVIDIA driver issue, an Intel driver issue, or a bandwidth limitation inside the system somehow. And what you see there is if you look at like the yellow and orange image with the close-up, you'll see that it's kind of like mixing the frames at the very end. And you can even kind of see like the step pattern where there's like a stripe of orange and then it's skinnier, and then a stripe of orange and then it's skinnier. And then you can see that it actually happens across the entire image, not just in the colored bar areas. And one or two of those would not be a problem. When you start to see a lot of them, you kind of visually see these little tears that kind of scroll up and down the screen while you're playing. It never got really bad on these configurations or anything, but it's a problem we would not have been able to find or at least describe very well without our capture method technology there. So it was interesting to see that result. We told NVIDIA about it. They duplicated it. They're working on a fix. And what I'm trying to do now is get a hold of an AMD, like a Haswell plus AMD discrete graphics notebook and see if the same kind of thing happens or if their version of Optimus that I think is called Enduro does the same thing. So more interesting graphics anomalies found through this capture.
You're just changing the industry one review at a time, young man.
We try.
You succeed.
We try.
AMD may discontinue the Radeon HD 7990. AMD says, no. This is a rumor. This is not a fact. We are denying it. We are telling you are full of bull hockey. Actually, plain and simple, AMD has not EOL'd the world's fastest graphic card, the AMD Radeon HD 7990. Why did WCCF Tech report that it was going away? Do we know?
No, I mean, I think
they heard news?
It was one of those rumors from a rumor from a rumor type of thing, I guess. But what's interesting about it was, you know, it's you could almost kind of see why they might do it, if that makes sense, without kind of being overly crass about it. Like the 7990 came out to kind of a thud as opposed to the fanfare that they were expecting, because you know all the stuff that I and some other websites have been writing about the problems with Crossfire, which 7990 depends on,
right?
And then there was a story on Tom's Hardware last month that talked about why no system integrators implement the 7990 because it gets too hot and it starts to throttle, and it's because of the cooler design and it creates this kind of inverse vacuum or whatever it is. It was a good story, you should go read that. And so you might go, well, maybe there's two reasons why they would just kind of maybe not cancel it, but just maybe kind of stop making it altogether.
Right.
When I contacted AMD about it, they of course denied it, said it was not the case, so they were continuing to make it going forward. If you look on Newegg right now, I'm actually looking there, and I see a whole bunch of them in stock, to be perfectly honest with you. I see anywhere from $899 to $1019. It looks like there's 8 or 9 of them in stock from Sapphire, PowerColor, VisionTech, XFX, MSI, Diamond, Gigabyte, all those guys. So if they did just do something to it, it hasn't affected stock or availability today. And the fact that you can get it for, actually you can get it for $849 after a $50 mail-in rebate, the power, that's actually an interesting thing. Until they get that new driver out, I don't think it's a worthwhile investment. But once they do, at $849, NVIDIA might have an interesting debate going on with the GTX 690 and GTX Titan.
That's the real reason they're discontinuing it. No one's actually buying them right now. Arbiter in the chat room points out $1,000 for a 7990 when 2X 7970s are $800. Well, it's actually $850. It's under $900 right now. Not that I can afford one for a 7990.
With the dual GPU cards, always more expensive than buying two of the single cards.
Right.
Because more engineering has to go into them, and they're really targeted at a different consumer. The person that buys a 7990 is usually somebody who isn't trying to save money and upgrade down the road.
Right.
Right. So they're definitely kind of targeted at different people.
Intel's Bay Trail can arm wrestle. Scott writes up at PC Perspective. Essentially, Bay Trail, the ARM competitor that will eventually be released sometime in the not entirely distant future from Intel, not to be vague, but you know, opening line, Bay Trail is still seasons away, but engineering samples are out. Quote, someone somewhere down the line decided to run a benchmark, which was posted online, Antutu. The benchmark utilized measures a spread of factors, including memory, integer performance. You would think I would be able to say that. Floating point performance, 3D performance, and so forth. Unfortunately, it does also include some non-CPU GPU factors in its score, albeit barely, so take it with a grain of salt. Silvermont-based chip clocked in a quite modest 1101 megahertz, received a synthetic score of 43,416. To put that in comparison, arguably the fastest ARM processor on the market, Qualcomm Snapdragon 800, tends to find itself with a score in the 30 to 32,000 range, so literally about 30% slower. And then it points out the Nexus 7 powered by the Tegra 3 scores 12,726. This sounds, I mean, is this the sign that Intel is going to come in and take names and kick ass and take over ARM's bread and butter? Or do you think this is a little early?
I think it's really early. There have been some other articles that have been posted from some other analysts talking about these results and this kind of issue. And it would appear that this particular benchmark, the Antutu benchmark, is maybe a little bit compromised in terms of how it's run. For example, one of the particular benchmarks, there's a bunch of different tests that happen in this benchmark, and one particular test, you know, it's compiled not with the GCC compiler, but rather the ICC compiler, which is the Intel built compiler, and it does some suspect things to improve performance on an Intel x86 platform.
Interesting. So
there's a lot of kind of debate going back and forth. ARM has kind of been out there saying, hey, you know, we're not going to come out and say that this benchmark is the worst ever, but we would highly encourage you to look at other tests as well. And it just so happens that the leaked results are only from this benchmark. So not very many people know what the rest of the benchmarks are showing yet. And so it's, you know, ARM's coming out saying, you know, they have to do damage control for something that is really kind of crappy. And I almost feel bad for them.
You're not going to say this, but I'm going to say it because I'm vile and disgusting and I live in California. Could perhaps someone inside of Intel have released this benchmark, which very specifically emphasizes the performance of the Intel processor at the expense of competitors that are shipping processors currently, like NVIDIA and ARM and Qualcomm?
It's entirely possible.
Yeah.
I mean, this stuff has happened for years and years. Even on the PC side, I can remember very specifically getting different MP3 encoding applications.
Right.
And they would, you know, this one would say this one was built with the GCC standard compiler. This one was built with the ICC or whatever derivative it was, Intel compiler. Look at the performance differences, and then here's look at AMD. And it was, you know, there's something to be said for Intel promoting, hey, if we can compile things better for our hardware and it runs better because of it, that's a positive and we should be able to promote that. And that's possible.
I mean, the illogical extreme of this was, I remember a certain processor that's no longer used by a certain manufacturer of OS X that may or may not be known as Apple. But it was so funny. It was like, I think it was like the G3. And they had this amazing ad about how their processor was like 30% faster than anything available on Intel that you could run Windows on. And it was like a tiny 4-point type at the bottom that you could barely see with a magnifying glass or an electron microscope. It was basically, you know, standard generic crap code that we found in an alleyway tested on Windows versus incredibly highly optimized code that our engineers polished to a highly buffed gleam before supercharging and dropping in freaking nitrous oxide. And I was just remember being like, you know, there's lies, damn lies, and benchmarks. And, you know, there's good benchmarking and bad benchmarking. And it's always, always take benchmarks in an advertisement or benchmarks from an anonymous source with several pounds, not grains of salt. But if it's even close to being legitimately true, it could be an interesting couple of years for AMD's various and sundry partners if they can actually deliver a part that's even remotely as fast as they're claiming they have right now and it taped out. That would be, I mean, how cool would that be? I mean, who thought Haswell was going to actually deliver a 50% performance 50% boost in battery life.
Yeah.
You know, Intel's got a lot of brain power on tap. You may have noticed Barnes & Noble is basically fire sailing their tablets. Amazon has started fire sailing their tablets. In Amazon, not so much as Barnes & Noble. But, you know, Kindle Fire HD is discounted from like $199 down to $169. Microsoft is cutting the price of the Surface RT tablets. I want to say The Verge has the report on that one. And essentially, basically, just a few days after Microsoft reports that they're going to have a new RT, Tom Warren writes up at The Verge, that they're going to start selling the Surface RT to schools for $199, and they're dropping the price of the 32-gigabyte Surface RT down to $350. And Staples, Mr. Warren confirms, has confirmed the price cut in a listing in its weekly promotional ads. The price cut comes into effect on Sunday, July 14th. So if you are one of the rare citizens who bought a Surface RT in the past few weeks, you should have waited. But like literally, it's a $150 cut in price, so from $500 to $350. That's a big honking drop in price, people.
Yep, yep.
And in other related Microsoft hardware news, since I'm officially afraid to even try to analyze the big management shakeup at Microsoft that went down this week or this morning, the Nokia Lumia 1020. So the next Windows phone from Nokia is essentially a 41-megapixel camera that makes phone calls. That's the version of it I like to look at. $299 at AT&T on July 26th. Early reports, and they are early, and they are from semi. Basically, if you want to see a really good-looking photo from well, we call these phones, Patrick, a really good-looking camera, or really good-looking photos from a camera on a phone. The Lumia 1020, they have one of the product managers, I believe, actually started posting pictures from the 1020 up on Flickr, and they look really freaking gorgeous. 1080p video camera, 4x zoom, 6x at 720p. I do not know if that is digital or analog. 38 megapixel and 4x3 and 16x9 aspect ratios, but it's pretty crazy. There it is. Optical image stabilization, 6-lens Zeiss optics, and a xenon flash. And it is huge on the back of that phone. It really is a camera that happens to also be a phone. And I'm not going to buy a Windows phone, but man, it's looking really cool.
I saw some of the user interface for, you know, being able to control all the functionality of the camera, and it actually looks really intuitive.
Right.
But I think the story I read was, unfortunately, it's tied to the Windows phone platform.
Well, right? They have apps.
They do. I know.
How many apps do you really need? How many apps can you use at one time?
I have a Samsung Galaxy, so technically I can use two at one time.
There you have it.
I've never done it, but technically I can do that.
I can use one at a time because I'm on iOS. Well, on a completely random note, Pebble, I'm just going to throw this in here before we get to our beloved viewer questions. I thought this was pretty interesting, partially because Robert Heron, my partner in crime in Techzilla, has one. The Pebble Watch, right? So it's the watch that's essentially a Bluetooth device that your phone talks to. They pre-sold like 80,000 of these for, you know, the Kickstarter project was ridiculous. And I think I put the wrong page in there for Burke. Let me cut in. Sorry, Burke. It's like, that's a 41 megapixel camera. That is not a watch, sir. The but they have sold over 270. No. That's exactly what the watch looks like on Robert Heron's wrist.
I'm telling.
I'll pick it up at the top. In three, two, and I just wanted to throw this in, possibly because my partner in crime, Robert Heron, on Techzilla, is a huge fan of his Pebble watch. Pebble says they've sold over 200, or has, excuse me, announced passing 275,000 device pre-orders and 1 million app downloads. So it's essentially, and it's kind of funny, right? So Pebble did a huge, ridiculously successful Kickstarter project for a Bluetooth watch. That is essentially an accessory for your phone. So, and part of the reason Robert likes it so much is because the watch vibrates when he gets a call or a text message. It does caller ID. It can read and respond. There's applications I can download in there. But I guess it's like 200,000, like 85,000 Kickstarter backers, another 200,000 people downloaded. And now Apple is in the process of sort of registering a trademark or a patent. So I want to say, I guess a trademark for their own watch name in several continents or several countries. It's kind of funny. Have you ever thought about, you know, getting sort of like Casio watch old school, the 1980s all over again, and having a computational device or an extension of your phone?
I would totally wear one, to be honest, because, you know, I have a Nike Fuel Band on my right wrist, and on my left wrist, I have a nice watch that I got at my wedding. I would totally wear like something like that, where I could look down and see my messages without pulling my phone out of my pocket, or if my phone's across the room at the office, right. I can look and see who's calling me, or who's texting me, or who's emailing me, without necessarily having, you know, to go find the phone or pull it out of your pocket, or, you know, while you're driving, it's easier to kind of look down and glance at things. And I would definitely do that if the product was right. And I just, maybe I misheard things from the early days of the Pebble, but my understanding was that did not work very well.
It seems to be, it seems to be working a lot better. They've certainly done some firmware updates, and they've added additional features. I think, where did it go? I'm going to also give props to the Next Web for a nice write-up on this one, but they've added a Gmail, here, an iOS update that will add Gmail and IMAP email notifications to the watch. And they're trying to open up an API that will allow developers to allow you to communicate from the watch through the phone to the internet. So it's interesting. Robert Heron's got one, absolutely loves it, hasn't broken it yet, which he's really excited about. I was actually surprised at how well-constructed the thing was. And by the way, they are now available for $150 at Best Buy stores. So if you're jonesing for one, you could go check one out on your way home if Best Buy's open late.
But maybe I'll take a look at that tomorrow. It could be interesting. Just what I need is something else to buy.
Damn. Because you need more hardware. Just sell a monitor, dude. You got like 9 extra monitors sitting in that room. Oh, my goodness.
Coming tomorrow.
You know, if Ryan chose a new cell phone provider, he would probably have more than enough money to buy that Pebble watch because he'd be saving so much every month. And the one we want to recommend is our sponsor. This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Ting.com. I now actually have my second device on Ting. I'm experimenting with an Android Galaxy Note 2 running on Ting just because I want to see how life is with the world's biggest phone in my pocket. I already have been a customer for a while out of my own pocket using Ting with a wireless modem that I purchased from Ting. And that's the big deal with Ting. Ting doesn't want a two-year contract. They don't want to keep stringing you along for months and months and years, ripping as much money out of your pocket as they can. Don't get me wrong. They're a for-profit company. But there's no contracts. There's no early termination fees, mostly because you buy your own hardware. You buy the hardware, and then you get to keep or end the contract when you want. It's pretty cool. Ting's an MVNO. Boy, I cannot do acronyms today, which is bad for a guy that's talking about hardware. But basically, they resell the Sprint's nationwide network. You can bring your own device now. It's pretty easy. I actually just brought a device onto Ting. You know, there's no weird charges. There's no bundling, no ride-along services. You choose, like, extra small through extra, extra large for phone calls, for text messages, for data. And extra small starts at $0. So if you basically do no text messages, you don't get charged for it. If you use no data, if I go a month without using my wireless modem, I pay $6. I pay $6 a month for the device. And then if I use a whole bunch of data, you know, gigabytes of data, I might pay $40 a month. Typical month, I'm paying $13 a month. That is less than a quarter of what I was paying per month for my previous modem. And I'm using it the same amount of time on and off again as I did previously. No weird charges, no mysterious line items on your bill. They've got a really simple interface. Tech support's amazing. I called them. I talked to somebody. They spoke an actual language I understood. They followed up with an email that actually gave all the information they discussed with me on the phone. It is great, and their online controls are fantastic. And you don't even have to go, don't start with the phone call, by the way, although it's lovely to talk to the people at Ting. You can start at help.ting.com. And we want to help you try out Ting.com. Go to Twitch, TWICH.ting.com. Save money, better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting. They've got a really cool savings calculator. So you can basically look at what you're paying now for your phone service and compare to what you would pay on Ting. And you might be shocked. You might be able to save $2,000 or $3,000 a year. Even with a very small family with a couple of people on it, you can save some significant coin. And you can actually see it right down there. Because you're listening to This Week in Computer Hardware, you can save $25 on your first Ting device because you buy your device, you own your device, you can take your device when you go, you can keep your device. Ting wants you to have a great experience, and they want to save you money. And you can save $25 on your first Ting device, twitch.ting.com. And if you're not going to buy a device, do us a favor. Go to twitch.ting.com if you decide to bring your own device, a Sprint device you already have, to the Ting network. It's good stuff, people. Check it out. Twitch.ting.com. And we want to thank them for supporting This Week in Computer Hardware. Uh-oh. I lost Ryan. He's fixed and dilated.
Nope,
he's
nope,
feral.
I'm here.
He's feral and excited.
So we want to remind people to send us in their emails. We have an email address set up just for them. It's Twitch, T-W-I-C-H, at twit.tv. If you have questions, comments, thoughts about some of the topics that we discussed, maybe you've got ideas about where 4K will be better or worse, or you can give better answers to any of the questions we're about to attempt to answer, send us an email, twitch at twit.tv. Go ahead.
You were talking about a $3,500 Ultra HD monitor.
What?
You own a $1,500 Seiki Ultra HD monitor, 4K monitor, and now Peter Tran, a.k.a. at Pit5000, says, look, $700 39-inch 4K TV up on Amazon.com, currently sold out since he posted it, but $700 for a 39-inch 4K Ultra HD, and this part might be a little deceptive, 120 hertz LED TV.
Yeah, so this is essentially the same. It's the same company that my 50-inch version comes from, and actually, that 50-inch TV is on sale at Amazon for $965.
Wow, that price went down fast.
It did. So take that for what you will. The 39-inch version, I don't think is out yet. I think it's just getting ready because I've been actually talking with the PR company for Seiki, trying to get one of those in here for testing as well. I don't think it's going to be any different technologically in terms of it's going to be a 30 hertz single input panel based on everything that I have seen so far. And unfortunately, like their website doesn't have the best technical specifications listed, and there's no like pictures of the back of it or anything like that. But my understanding is that this is essentially the 55 inch TV taken down to 39 inches with a drop in price. Still, if this sells at $699 for a 39-inch 4K TV, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. It's probably not going to have the best black levels out there, certainly not compared to some of the plasmas that are available. You know, it may have some uneven LED lighting issues, judging from some of the lower scoring reviews that are already up on Amazon.com. But if you want to have a ridiculous number of pixels packed into a 40-inch screen in front of your face, if you've always dreamed of having an HDTV for a monitor, 4K would be sweet. I think you'll have a better experience with the $3,500 4K monitor that Ryan's going to be looking at tomorrow. But you could buy five of these for the same price. Seven of these? Seven times? Six times six? Six. Five. Five and a half? Five plus shipping?
Still.
Five plus tax?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. But, so yeah.
I'm looking at their website. The 39-inch does say 4K is 30 hertz only.
Yeah.
Still
not bad, perfectly acceptable for video, not bad for desktop usage. Some people, Ryan hasn't had that many issues with 30K gaming, but some people I know have been utterly horrified by the 30 frame per second gaming experience of 4K HDTVs, because that's a lot of pixels to update it for 30 frames per second.
It is.
Matt's got a question about an SSD screw up. He says, "Hey guys, love the show. I was looking to get a new SSD as my current Corsair Force 360 gig is full. After checking the PC per hardware leaderboard, I decided to check some other sites before buying. Harddrivebenchmark.net placed an SSD called the Samsung MZ-HP-U256-HCGL-umpteen-zeros very close to the top. However, when searched on Amazon, I get the OCZ Vector. Are these SSDs the same, or is this an Amazon glitch? Thanks, and keep up the awesome podcast." Thank you, Matt.
That's a glitch.
Yeah.
That may also be clever marketing on OCZ's part. Like, if they include in their description something, mm-hmm. you know, with that specific model number, that right. they're definitely not the same part. Yeah, they're not. I don't know.
It's no. One, no.
It's not
two.
It's not a bad SSD, though. It's
no.
just that's not the one you searched for.
Yeah, I would also say, to be perfectly blunt and honest with you, you are not going to notice in real world, any type of real world computing, non-benchmark analysis, you are not going to notice the difference between those SSD drives. It's just, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I'd agree. I did a regular Google search for that drive, and not really coming up with much either. Harddrivebenchmark.net, which you linked in there as well. So,
yeah,
I don't think that may be an OEM part number as opposed to an actual retail availability part number.
Well, what's funny is if you search for that part number, I'm looking at the first, the second, the third. Three of the first four listings on that all point back to harddrivebenchmark.net.
Yeah, that indicates to me that this is not...
We like to call that a glitch.
Right, it's not the right number you're looking for to search for to purchase this particular product to replace it. So,
I want to get the OV1 wave. This is not the SSD you're looking for.
There are lots of other SSDs, but this is not the one you're looking for.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Allison's got an email about laptop hard disk drive installation. She says, "The OCZ Vertex drive I purchased after reading your review in December proved not to be a great investment. It has just failed." Sorry to hear that, Allison.
Yeah.
"When I pulled it out of my Lenovo X220, the plastic tab that Lenovo provides for insertion and retrieval self-destructed. Now I am about to insert the new Samsung 840 MLC 256GB drive I should have purchased and wish I were putting a retrieval handle on it, but feel like putting a piece of electric tape may do more harm than good. Do you have any suggestions?" I'm a big fan of the miracle of blue painter's tape. You know?
Yeah. You know, that'll come off easy.
3 inches of blue painter's tape, fold over the fold 1 inch over the next inch, put the next inch on the drive, insert the drive in there. Electrical tape will work well. My issue with electrical tape is the glue on electrical tape tends to do strange and unfortunate things when it gets warm, and the inside of your laptop will get warm.
My recommendation, if you have access to it, is gaff tape.
Yeah.
Because my only issue may be with the painter's tape is that it might come loose, right? And then when you're trying to pull that hard drive back out, that kind of defeats the purpose.
Well,
gaff tape would have a much stronger hold. I don't think you have to worry about, like, the the tape messing with the inside of your laptop. I put this question here because I have this exact same issue with my laptop here.
Right.
I replaced the hard drive that it came with an SSD. The SSD didn't fit in the mounting mechanism at all. So it's actually just kind of sitting in there. There's actually like a piece of foam like stuffed in there to make sure that it doesn't wiggle around.
People
it's got a piece of F tape so that you can pull it back out if you want to. SSDs are versatile. They're not, you can't hurt them.
People always expect us to have these really sophisticated, you know, computers with this amazing cabling, and it always looks like the dog threw up inside my computer, but it's fast and it runs and it never fails and everything's cool. But yeah. I've the number of things I've duct taped in my life, or gaffers taped as the case may be, in the last couple of years, including hard drives.
My cousin once brought his PC over. He just upgraded it. He hadn't upgraded in a long time, and he bought an SSD. He was really proud of it, but his case was older. Didn't have a place for an SSD. So he's like, I didn't know what to do. I don't know where to mount it. I didn't know what to do. So I literally went to the shelf. I took a piece of gaff tape about this long, and I ripped it off. I put it on the SSD, and I taped it to the bottom of the case. And I said, there you go. You're good. It's not going to affect anything.
What about cooling? Not really going to impact it, but nope. Don't
worry about it. Gaff tape is the most used item at this office, for sure, for anything.
If you can't find gaffer's tape because it's expensive and difficult to locate in many local hardware stores and big box stores, consider something like Gorilla Tape, which is even more frightening, but will actually hold an aluminum airstream together when it's wet. Ask me how I know. One last question before we go. John's looking for a USB 3.0 hub. He says, hi, I've been trying to find a good USB 3.0 hub. I've looked online and found a few good candidates, but with mixed reviews. I was wondering if you guys have any that you like. Thanks for your help, John. I have been searching for a USB 3.0 hub myself because I'm starting to have a small collection of USB 3.0 devices, including drives. I have noticed over the last several emerging sort of new interface technologies I've dealt with over the last few years is that, you know, a lot of things people attribute to problems with a hub may actually be problems with the device implementation, but all of them should work because USB 3.0 is a fairly simple standard, but none has emerged as a clear winner that I've seen so far.
Yeah, I'm kind of looking on Newegg, and there are some. I wonder if maybe if there's a potential issue with the fact that if you're trying to use a passive one, right, because USB 3 requires a little bit more power. It's running at a bit of higher speed. I'm like there's one from Tech Republic on Newegg that is $15.99. It's got 7 5-star reviews or 5 egg reviews.
Oh,
on Newegg.
Here, so I found it. You know what? I swear to goodness, when I searched this earlier, it wasn't there. There's the Anker U-Speed USB 3.0 7-port hub with 36-watt power adapter. And like Ryan's saying, get one with a power adapter or your life will suck. $39.99, Amazon Prime, 793 reviews, an average of 4.5-ish stars. So I'm going to say I'm buying the Anker tonight. This is exciting. Where was this when I looked for it?
A-N-K-E-R, right?
A-N-K-E-R.
Okay.
Yeah. Anker U-Speed USB 3.0 7-port hub with 36-watt power adapter and 3-foot USB 3.0 cable with the VIA VL812 chipset, $40, Amazon Prime. Order it in the next 20 hours and get it by Monday, July 15th.
I think, honestly, that's been the kind of the problem why it took so long for USB 3 hubs to come out is that the all the controllers that were built for USB 3 were bandwidth restricted.
Right.
And so it has taken a while for more of these to come out. I wouldn't be surprised even if it's a 4-port hub, if it's bandwidth limited to maybe 1 or 2 maxed out, right? The whole idea is if you're trying to run 4 external hard drives on this, you're not going to get, you know, if you can copy data to or from all of them at the same time, it's not a good idea. But if you, you know, you just for convenience, you want these all connected at the same time, you should be good.
Yeah, I will also say apparently Anker has a new U-Speed USB 3.0 7-port hub plus 2 charging ports, 5-volt 2.1 amp and 5-volt 1.5 amp. That's really cool.
It's $49 plus shipping.
Oh, I should also point out that apparently the 793 is for Anker? And not the particular product, Let me just double check that real quick. Nope. Looks like people, yeah, people like it. Okay, so they have a 4-port plus 1 charging port, a 7-port plus 2 charging port, a 7-port, and a 7-port plus 1 charging point. So there are 4 variations on their 4 and 7-port USB 3.0 hubs.
I like it.
I like it. So yeah, 793 reviews and 4.5 stars is a good sign that the product does not suck. Oh my goodness. Dude, I am so excited. We have the $300 printer bot in, and we are going to. I'm going to be building it tomorrow.
That's pretty awesome.
I am so freaking excited. It's my first 3D printer.
I have never used one myself. I would like to see what your result is and maybe purchase one.
It's very small. It will produce very small objects, and I think it's going to be fun to bring it home. Just watch my son absolutely freak out as you know. I print out chess pieces for him or something. So I will keep you posted, and that's going to be up to build, and what happens in the build will be up on Techzilla next week. PC Purr cranking out additional giant case. Are you done with the giant case market? Has the giant case market been exhausted?
We have a medium case review coming up. we have our 4K Asus PQ321 monitor that we're going to do. Well, tomorrow we'll probably do some kind of like live stream where we unbox it and set it up and show everybody how it works. And then we'll spend some more time early in the week benchmarking it and then come up with a good article by probably mid next week on image quality and all that kind of stuff. And we also have QuakeCon coming up. This is probably the first week I've been on Twitch since we officially committed to doing our hardware workshop at QuakeCon again. That's a 2,400 person LAN party in Dallas, Texas on Saturday afternoon. We do a workshop. We get about 2,000 PC gamers into a room and give away a bunch of stuff. Corsair, Asus, NVIDIA, Gigabyte, MSI, they're all donating hardware for us to raffle off, and then we'll have NVIDIA come up and do some demos on stage. And it's a fun time. Even if you don't go to the LAN party, to the BYOC, you can still register at QuakeCon.org and go to the different shows and events and that kind of stuff. John Carmack does a keynote on that stage on Thursday afternoon. So there's some really interesting things there. We'll be there again. This is our fourth or fifth year? 9, 10, 11, 12. This will be our fifth year. This will be our fifth year doing that workshop. So we're excited. There's a lot of stuff for me to do still. 2 weeks
or so. Dude, you're always packing like up to the minute. Are you driving or flying this year?
We're driving again. what's even worse is I'm going on a vacation with my family to the Outer Banks, which is in North Carolina. Yeah.
Yes.
And driving home, and then 2 days after I get home, I drive to Dallas.
It's like barbecue tour your way across the South, dude. I'm officially jealous.
Well, it's like 13 hours to where we're going in Outer Banks, 13 hours back, 15 hours to Dallas, 15 hours back.
Outer Banks is nice, though.
I'm looking forward to it.
I got to say, if you're shopping for satellite radio, the XM stuff seems to sound better than the Sirius. It seems to be less compressed because I recently rented a car. And it's like, you know, satellite radio sucks a lot less than it used to audio-wise.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. You're still going to be trapped in a car with your relatives. That may be good. It may be bad. But the Outer Banks is always good. Also always good, you people. Thank you so much for joining us. Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. You can email us, as we mentioned earlier, twitch@twit.tv, twich@twit.tv. You can find all the episodes of Twitch. If you want to listen to each and every one of them, we highly recommend you do. Tell all your friends about them. Go to twit.tv/twitch. That's a hard thing to say. I'm not going to try to say it twice. Join us next week. We record live on Thursday evenings at 6 o'clock Pacific, 9 o'clock Eastern. And Mr. Ryan Shrout, I think, is going to go back and attempt to continue getting his clock back on Eastern Standard Time from Greenwich Mean Time.
I never really left it. I went to bed early and got up early. Not 5 hours early, but close enough. Yeah, plus everything in London shut down at 6 p.m. It was really weird. I didn't really know.
You must have been in the wrong part of London, dude.
It's in the old people part, I guess.
Or maybe the downtown businessy part. But, you know, because Trenton shuts down pretty early last, I remember. But
true.
I don't even want to start talking about that. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this episode of Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.